a little bit about some work I did together this summer with Jeff Swollen. The title of the talk is Self-Adjusted Quantum Errors, and this is sort of a reference to the quote I have here at Bismarck. And the idea is, if you have a sausage on your plate, the thing to do is not ask what kind of brains and guts and goo it's made of. You just ask yourself, does it taste good? And I guess quantum states are a little bit like this, too. You know, if there's been some noise on your quantum state, and you'd like to reverse that noise, sometimes rather than just asking, what error occurred, and then correcting it, you're better off sort of just asking, how can I correct what occurred, not asking for the identity of the error. Okay. So this is a distinction between non-degenerate codes, right, which uniquely identify which errors happen with a syndrome, and degenerate codes, where sort of so there are multiple errors whose action on the code space is identical. And then you assign the same syndrome to a large family of errors. Actually, so it's known, I guess, since 96 that degenerate codes can actually let you communicate over channels for which no non-degenerate code can give you non-zero rate. OK? And this somehow, I guess it, I mean, yeah, so it illustrates kind of an annoying feature of the noisy channel coding theorem for quantum channels. So I guess first I should I'll tell you about the classical coding theorem. So you probably know this. So I have some classical channel called N. It maps on input variable X to an output Y. And then the classical capacity is just, well, it's the mutual information between X and Y, optimized over distribution of the input variable. OK, and this is just, I should remind you that it's mutual information is x plus y minus xv. OK, what you might hope for the, I guess, quantum coding theorem is, well, some analog of this. Right? So rather than mutual information, you might want the coherent information. So you have now, let's say, polarizing channel maps qubits to qubits, like this. So with probability p, you have noise, and that's equally distributed over x, y, and z errors. And one potential capacity formula you might have, or you might hope for, is, well, hopefully the quantum capacity of your channel is just the supremum over all input states. So Alice keeps something, and then call it A prime system. And then she feeds the A system into the channel. The coherent information of, well, A given B, evaluated on the following state. Just, well, what you get when you put half this phi through the channel. And where this thing, again, is what? Just entropy B minus entropy AB. And it's sort of the right thing. It's the right quantum analog of mutual information in this case, or it seems like. And then the point is, well, this is what you might hope for. And this is, in fact, the capacity of the polarizing channel for if you sort of restrict to using non-degenerate codes. But then Shoren Swollen showed that in 96 that actually you can do better than this. So the capacity is strictly larger in some cases. The right formula is actually, well, you need to consider input states that are entangled across multiple uses of the channel. So now, instead of one use of the channel, you have n. And these are all fairly large systems. And then you get this expression. And I guess classically, the way you would prove this is first you show something like that expression is the capacity, and then you show, well, actually, you don't need to regularize. This is just equal to that. But in the quantum case, it's this is not the case. OK. And I guess, I mean, it's really annoying that, this is so, right? Because, well, in this case, you know, you can evaluate this thing, maybe using a computer. And you can get an idea for any given channel what the capacity is, roughly. For this, you kind of have a problem. You have to optimize over an arbitrarily large number of variables. So you can't get a handle on the capacity of basically any channel. Well, there are a couple of examples where you can, but the depolarizing channel, which is sort of, I guess, the most natural notion of, noise, sort of at a given error rate, well, we have no idea what the capacity is.
Is it known that you, I mean, essentially this is saying that the coherent information is not additive across the product.
Correct.
And you're saying that Smolman required a non-degenerate code to get past that. Is it known that, you have to have, or just that that was the way he was able to do it?
Oh, I mean, it's certainly true that you have to have them.
So non-degenerate codes could not.
Yeah, non-degenerate code can't be this sort of single letter thing.
When you said you have no idea what the capacity is, I mean, there are upper bounds and lower bounds.
Yeah. So we have some idea, I guess. But
how does it go? Can you just summarize more or less how it looks at this?
Sure. How about I say for now it's a lot, and then I have a slide with pictures on it. Okay. Well, I was going on about why I don't like this formula, and well, we can't evaluate it. Like the question, right? It's not clear what this has to do with degenerate codes, right? Although somehow it the fact that we need to regularize does somehow express this need for degenerate codes, but it's not clear. I mean, it doesn't really tell us what the code should look like, which is annoying. And that sort of also is a feature of the Shor-Smolman result, but well, it's not clear. They have some codes and they show that they do slightly better than this. Oh, and the last thing I want to complain about is how slightly better they do. So this is the error probability for a depolarizing channel, where you just look at the sort of one sort of single letter expression, which is like the best you can do with a non-degenerate code. This is where the rate goes to zero. And then Shor and Smolman, first, I guess in 96, they showed that you can push this all the way up to 0.1903. Right? And this took sort of this was entangled across five channels. And then working really hard, they also showed, I guess, that David did in Trento, you can push it to 0.1906. And this is an entanglement across 25 challenges. And it seems like, you know, the returns are not really, I mean, you have to work too hard to get such a small return, right? And we're not supposed to, I don't know, we're not supposed to have to do coding if we just want to know the rate, right? We're supposed to choose a random code. Okay, good. Which is why I conclude this is a violation of the deal. And the deal is, if you don't care about constructing the objects, then just choose something at random and it should be optimal. And, well, look, I mean, it's a standard technique in combinatorics, and it's sort of the only technique in information theory. And it's not working here somehow, and it's not clear why. So I guess my goal is that I tell you a little bit about why this seems to fail, and hopefully we can understand, I don't know, maybe not come up with a new deal involving degeneracy, but maybe we can understand a little bit about why it is a particular code, what we should be looking for in terms of our codes.
Grab all your signatures are suspiciously like they're in the same handwriting.
Oh, it's different dates, though.
Who's the third one?
Joel Spencer.
These guys no, that's the fourth one.
Oh, that's Noel Long. So there's this probabilistic method book, you know,
by Long and Spencer.
We should have used different ink. Okay, sorry. So here's how we're going to sort of get at, I guess, hopefully a better understanding of, this is the roadmap, a better understanding of these degenerate codes. And I think, well, I'll try to keep it really brief on the discussion of random stabilizer codes. I just will, because probably everybody here knows it already. The point is, what we've been looking at is, Schwartz and Smolin sort of looked at this family of codes for the depolarizing channel that involves these highly degenerate repetition codes. And I'll look a little bit, or sort of, I'll tell you a little bit about how those things behave on a generalized Bell diagonal channel. And the answer, well, I don't want to spoil it. We get big deviations from hashing, where big is compared to this. So they're still sort of not too huge. Then maybe I'll focus on sort of particular family of channels where the behavior is very strange, and we can actually learn a little bit about what the degeneracy is doing, or how exactly the optimal code is using degeneracy to improve the grade. And then I guess I'll finally show you one channel where, well, nothing works, or nothing we know how to do works, so then the conjecture is nothing works. So.
In terms of the deal for classical codes,
yeah.
Can you say, is it sufficient to choose a random linear code?
But you got to, you don't just choose a random linear code with a 50-50 probabilities, you have to choose sort of the best distribution, but yeah, you can just, what is it, Wolfowitz or something show this thing? But yeah, random linear code.
Well, you have to have the symmetric channels.
Okay. I mean, I only think of the, well, yeah, that's the only channel I know how to work. Do you know in general?
No, it doesn't.
Doesn't work in general, okay. Okay, good. So this is one. Okay, this will be, well, stabilizer codes. What are they? Well, we let AN be the polygroup, X, Y, and Z's, and choose an abelian subgroup of the polygroup. And the size has to be the power of 2. The code is just a thing whose is just a subspace. All of whose elements are eigenvectors of everything in the stabilizer with eigenvalue 1. And then the dimension of the code is somehow related to the size of stabilizers, so the stabilizer is 2 to the n minus k, and the dimension of the code is 2 to the k, and we have k encoded qubits in sort of n logical qubits. And then the syndrome of a particular error, E, which will be also in the poly group, is just, well, given to you by commutation relations of the error on a generating set of the stabilizer. Everybody know this? Okay, here's a picture of that. Right. Encode. Here's an error. I decode and measure the syndromes. And then I do something based on this to correct for what I measure. Okay, and if I choose one of these things at random, it does pretty well. So if I have the depolarizing channel, like we were saying earlier. And then if I have sort of a large number of uses of the channel, and a set of typical errors. And these are exactly the errors where the number of x, y, and z, x, y's, and z's in the errors is roughly roughly what you would expect given the distribution. And then the total number of them is just something like 2 to the n times the entropy of the error. And then when you choose, well, if you just choose a single generator for your stabilizer group at random, so you choose your first one at random, well, what it'll do with high probability is, well, just split the typical errors in two, well, in half, right? So roughly half of the typical errors will commute with it, roughly half will anticommute. And you can see, if you keep doing this, well, sort of the n times the entropy of the error rate, n times the entropy of the errors number of times, then you've basically gotten it down to a unique error with each, with each set of symbols. Right. And so the sort of shows you, I guess, that that if you choose your code at random, then you can get a, well, as long as the rate is less than this expression, so 1 minus binary entropy of p minus, well, this term is just telling you that there are three different kinds of errors that could happen. So as long as you choose the rate less than this, which is like the hatching rate, or the single letter rate in the expression for the capacity I was talking about earlier, then your random code gives you high fidelity with high probability. And if you choose anything, any rate higher than that, well, you basically get bad fidelity with high probability. So here's a summary of that, and also of some of the bounds that you have. So sort of answers your question now, I guess. So it seems, well, what have I got here? Well, this green line is just the hashing rate. So that's the rate at which this is the rate you can get at where when you choose a random stabilizer code. And then I've included the improvement over this line due to Shore and Smolin, but as you can see, it's you can't really see it, maybe. And that's appropriate because it's very small. And then, well, I mean, what I'm showing you, this hashing rate and also Shore Smolin rate, somehow a lower bound on the capacity. And you can see we're not very good at doing anything besides choosing things at random. And it's almost like, well, you see, I guess the only thing we're worse at getting lower bounds is getting upper bounds, because those are quite hard to get to. So these two upper bounds that I'm showing you here, this purple one is sort of, a relative entropy bound. It's due to rings. And then this line here is like an opponent bound. So you can see it goes to zero at error probability 1/4. And this is something like 0.19. So there's a pretty big gap. And I put this dotted line here because, I like doing upper bounds too. And if you want to know about how to get this upper line, come ask me later. But for now, we'll just work on this.
So that is an upper bound, dotted line?
Yeah. Okay, so what I want to do is try to get a handle on why a particular degenerate code is good for a given channel. So instead of just depolarizing channels, we'll look at polling channels, right? So we have the errors are x, y's, and z's, and they all happen with sort of different error probabilities. And well, what can we do with hashing? If we choose a random code, we get this sort of 1 minus the entropy of the errors here. And the question is, can we do better? The answer is almost always. And I guess with the caveat that not too much better. I think we can. Well, good. I'll show you how now. So for now, I just I'll stick with the a very simple family of codes, the repetition code. And the idea is, well, for logical zero, just have a bunch of zeros, and then for logical one, just have a bunch of ones. Right? This is sort of very, this is like the most naive classical code you can come up with. And then the stabilizer, you can just write it like this. You know, this is z1, z2. That just tells you that in the z basis, the first and second qubit better agree, first and third better agree, etc. So this whole stabilizer tells you that, well, they all better agree. It's going to be in the code space. And you can see that, well, two things. First, the logical x, you know, the thing that maps logical 0 to logical 1, that's just x on all of the different qubits. And then logical z, well, as long as you have a single z acting on one of the qubits, you're fine. And this is kind of the essential part, because a z acting on the first qubit has the same action as a z acting on the second qubit, has the same action as any number of z errors, as long as they're odd. Right? So this is where you get this collapse of all of your errors, or sort of many of your typical errors, down onto the same syndrome. So this is where the degeneracy comes in, right? Sort of that. And the encoding and decoding operations are, well, like this. You just use sort of control knots from the qubit you want to encode down to all of these ancillary qubits, and then you chuck them through the channel. The decoding is also just a bunch of C knots. And then at the end, you measure a bunch of zeros and ones. And there's sort of two features that make this a nice code to use for, well, there are two features of this code that I guess make it somehow better than random sometimes. And the first is, like I said, it's degenerate. All of these z sub i's are the same, basically, on the code space. But somehow it's a little surprising that, well, it's a little odd that it would be better than random code, because it has a poor distance, right? It can, well, it's as bad as it gets. It's got distance 1. But in some sense, it's also got sort of a high x distance, right? So you've got these two things working for you. First is that you're learning sort of a lot about the amplitude errors or the x errors here. And then you're collapsing down a lot of the z errors. And what we'll do is, after using this code, we'll concatenate it, I don't like the word that that's people use. We'll have a bunch of qubits encoded in many different repetition codes. And then we'll choose a random code on top of that. And this is what's going to give us better than just a random code. So I guess picture of that is here. So here, I guess I have. You know, I have. Let's say, you know, I have some. Let's say it's a repetition length n. So there are n qubits in each of these subblocks. And then I take sort of a large number of subblocks like that, and then I choose a random code on the whole code space. And I guess the nice thing is that because this sort of inner code, this is called the inner code, and then the random one's called the outer code. Because the inner code's so simple, you can actually, I guess, get fairly nice expressions for what the rate is when you use this random code. But I guess instead of I could sort of put it up here. It's not very informative. Instead, I'll just sort of show you an example of the rates you can achieve using this idea for various different repetition code lengths. And this is sort of, well, the channel is chosen sort of to make the effect as strong as possible. So I've got sort of fairly high probability of x errors, y and z errors, similar probability, a few, maybe twice as many z's as y's, but far fewer than there are x's. And there's sort of, I guess, two things you can see happening here. So the first is, well, this is a two-qubit repetition code, and this red one's hashing. The first is that you can see, well, the rate's kind of bad over here for these repetition codes. And that's because you're already giving up sort of a factor of 1 over the length of the repetition code. Right? So there's no way with the 2-qubit repetition code you can do any better than rate 1/2 ever. And then the second thing that's happening sort of is that, well, the longer I make the repetition code, or at least as I increase the length of the repetition code, the 0 pushes out a little bit. Right, so the 0 goes out further. Well, it turns out actually it's even more interesting than that. So you increase it, and eventually the 0 sort of goes out as far as it's going to go, and by increasing the repetition length anymore, you don't have it starts getting worse again. Right? So there's somehow an optimal repetition length to use for a given channel. And this is pretty typical for basically any poly channel, except for the exception I'll mention a little bit later. So if you look at, well, the optimal, if you sort of take the maximum of the optimal repetition length at any given error probability, right, what you get is this blue curve. So down to, I don't know, error probability, well, when the rate gets below, say, 1/20th, somehow this degenerate code, these degenerate codes take over. In general, sort of the closer you are to the left, the shorter the degenerate code is. And I just want to point out, I guess, this goes from something like 0.29 to like 0.31, or, well, 0.29 to 0.3 at least, which is somehow, I guess, much bigger than this, right? It's somehow, I guess, well, let me just plot for you the whole range of error probabilities. So the point is, you can see it on this graph, right? A little bit, right there. Right, and this is somehow telling us, well, this is maybe, I don't know. Well, the point is, you couldn't see it on the previous graph, and I was even making it too big on the previous graph. So I guess the point is, this is if you want to understand the capacity of this channel, you can't just go ahead and say, well, hashing's roughly right, and well, we know that there's this super additivity, but it's a small effect. Well, this is sort of only moderately small. And I think the reason for the moderately smallness is not that there aren't better codes, but just that we aren't better coders or something, I think. OK, so let me just, I guess, go on a little bit about where the degeneracy is in these codes. OK, so imagine now that we have a repetition length, a repetition code with block length m. And we're going to use sort of, that's going to be a fixed constant. And then we're going to have a large number of blocks encoded in that, sort of each of which is encoded in that. And now I've sort of, I guess, written out some typical errors. And the point is that, well, there are going to be a lot of typical errors, or actually there'll be exponentially many typical errors that are related by these elements of the stabilizer of the inner curve. Right? So they're all going to be, all of these, well, these three errors are all going to have the same action on the sort of logical code space given by all of these encoded inner codes. Oh, sorry, on all of these inner codes. Right? So when we choose a random stabilizer on that, when we choose a random code on that, then we're only going to need to spend, say, one syndromon on this group of errors. And this is somehow what saves us, or what allows us to do a little better than hashing. So the point where the hashing rate goes to zero is exactly where the total number of the typical errors is exactly equal to the dimension of it's when the entropy of the errors, it's when the entropy per qubit on your state, when the entropy per qubit goes to 1, right? So you have to sort of, if you want to learn about every typical error, you have to sort of measure every qubit. So I guess an informative example sort of helps you figure out a little bit what's going on, is if we look at sort of channels that are fairly close to bit foot channels. So the point is we want to have X probability to be much, much larger than Z probability. And just for making things easier, we'll have independent amplitude and phase errors, right? The point is, well, we want to know, how does the optimal block length or repetition length scale for this delta? That scale is a function of delta. So when delta is equal to 0, we have just the bit foot channel. And this is one of the few channels for which we know the capacity. And actually, we know that random coding or hashing is off. Right, so like I said, we want to know how does the optimal end scale with delta? And just to note, you know, the size of the effect at least better go to 0 as delta goes to 0. Which it does. But what doesn't go to 0, what sort of does the opposite, is the optimal repetition code length. So as delta goes to 0, the optimal length gets huge. All right, so along here we have, I guess, the ratio of Z errors to X errors. You can see as it gets small, the best repetition code length gets huge. And it seems a little odd, but I guess by looking at why this is happening, let's look at why this is happening. And what's kind of happening is that, well, the bigger you make, or the longer you make your repetition code, the more you learn about these, the more you learn about the X errors, right? Because, maybe it's not obvious, but the logical X error will just, it will be exactly whatever X error happened on the first cue. And what you do with this repetition code is you just measure the parity of whatever the X error is with something which has, hopefully, with something that has a probability less than 1/2 of having an error, right? So you do this a bunch of times, and eventually you get pretty sure about what the X error is. And the trade-off is sort of that, well, every time you measure this, you sort of propagate the phase error, the Z, from this cue back onto that cue. Right, so if we have this long repetition code, and what we're going to get as syndromes is just U1, the parity of U1 and U2, parity of U1 and U3, all the way up to U1 and UM. So we're learning a lot about the X, but then what we pay back is that, the Z error is just going to be the parity of all the Z errors of all these qubits. And then you can kind of see from this why you might expect now to get scaling that sort of gets huge as the probability of a Z error gets small. It's because, although this thing increases, sort of the entropy of this parity increases with m, if we take m to be roughly 1 over the Z error probability, then this thing is actually going to be well less than 1. It's going to be the entropy roughly of something like, basically it's going to be much more likely that there's an even number of Z errors than there's an odd number of Z errors. So this is going to be much, much less than 1. Or it's going to be something like a third, I don't know. But if you make it much bigger, right, if you take the parity of much more than sort of, 1 over PZ, that's roughly the number of Z errors you're going to expect, I think. Let's see. No, that's roughly the block length where you expect one Z error. Sorry, right? And if you take the length much larger than that, right, you're going to be you're going to be totally cooked because you're going to have if you have more than, if you typically have a large number of zeros, and you want to look at the entropy of the parity of all the z's, that's going to be pretty close to 1, right? And it turns out, at least at the hashing point, right, that that this is actually large enough to know just about everything about the U1. So you sort of drain almost all the entropy out of the excess, and then you come out of it with less than a bit of entropy in the z's, actually much less. I mean, somehow this is better than when you started, right? If you were at the point where there was a total of one bit in each qubit, one bit of entropy. I mean, is this at all clear? Okay. So I mean, this analysis was sort of just for these, I guess, almost bit flip channels. But it's true in general that, you know, 1/PZ is a pretty good repetition length to use. Roughly for the same argument, but it's only precise when you take that limit. Well, I guess you can also see from that example that, let me flip that. I guess you can also see here that, what's the induced error model here, right? Well, we went from having fairly low probability of z errors, fairly high probability of x errors, to pretty well knowing the x and having a fairly high probability of z error. Right? And that's also true in general, not just for this sort of limiting case. And well, it suggests what should you do next? Well, you sort of concatenate with similar repetition code in the conjugate basis. And I don't know, I like the depolarizing channel, or I want to know more about it, so we can apply this idea to the depolarizing channel, right? So use sort of the best Z code you can come up with. And this sort of, if you start with probability x bigger than probability z, then you end up with probability z bigger than probability x, right? And the channel you get up, it's perfect for a repetition code in the x basis rather than the z basis. So in the case of the depolarizing channel, you don't start off with probability x bigger than probability z, but you do end up with probability z bigger than probability x when you start with these two are equal.
After you do
correction. Yeah,
after you do
you do correction on the inner code, you end up getting more z-errors than x's.
What do you call something on z-code?
The one that gives you the best zero. Say.
Okay, so z-code we call it for b.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so these are the stabilizers. Okay, so I guess I've done this. I just want to show you the result of that. Well, so what's along here? This is I'm taking two repetition codes now, right? So one is just a 3-qubit repetition code, and the second one has length m in the conjugate basis, and I'll go from m equals 0 to m equals 30 or something like that. And here I plot the sort of, this is the first Schwarzmullen, and this is the Divincenzo Schwarzmullen code here. So this is a 5-qubit repetition, and this is 5 and 5. And then what you can see is that, if I take a 3-qubit repetition code and then keep increasing the length of the outer code, what am I plotting here? I'm plotting the probability where the chief rate goes to zero. And you can see, what happens? So I start off with 3 in sort of 1, so sort of no repetition code, and then I keep increasing the length, and the zero rate probability keeps getting better until I get to some place where basically I've got got a repetition code sort of optimized for the conditional error from the original repetition code, and then things start getting worse. This gives you something slightly better, only than polarizing, sorry, than the previous sort of 5 in 5 thing. And you can do this now with 5 in n codes. They sort of do, well, you can do slightly better than this, but then plotting it gets kind of hard. Because these sort of concatenation of two repetition codes, you can't completely, you can get an analytic expression, but it's the sum of a large number of terms. At some point, it gets hard to count all those terms. So things get slow. And I should mention that this is basically, the depolarizing channel is sort of where you get sort of, I guess, one of the weakest effects in terms of degenerate codes over non-degenerate, at least in terms of, well, at least in the families that we're using. So the channel I showed you earlier, which was highly asymmetric, that somehow you get a much greater difference between the halving rate and what you can do with these repetition codes. And I guess there are two exceptions. The first is just the bit flip or the phasing channel. These are channels which are known to have sort of rate which is, a rate which is equal to the single letter formula, the just sort of non-degenerate rate. But there's a sort of family of channels for which doesn't seem to be true. A single channel and things that are extremely close to it. So for basically all channels, there's some repetition length that'll be hatching, and except for the decaying ones, and then also this sort of two poly channel with equal probabilities x and z's. Right, so you have probability p of an error, and that'll either be an x or a z, but there'll be no y's. Can we try, I guess, all repetition? Try the repetition codes sort of for a reasonable number of repetitions, and just keeps getting worse when you make the repetition length longer. You can also try sort of concatenating repetition codes in various combinations. That doesn't work either. It's certainly different from the other polys, even if it's not the case that hashing is optimal. But I mean, the guess is that, well, hashing is probably optimal. And then you try to show this, and the only, well, all of the channels for which hashing is known to be optimal have this probability, this property called the degradability, right? which you can use to prove that, public capacity is just a single letter thing. What's degradability? That's just when, if I give you the output of the channel, you can do some post-process. You can process that in some way, and then you'll end up with, you'll end up having created the conjugate channel, or complementary, the channel that this thing induces on the environment, right? So you have this map from A to B and E, and this is like an isometry. And then to get the channel, you trace out. To get the channel, you just trace out E. And then to get the. I'm forgetting right now. Is it complementary or conjugate channel? If I trace out B, I get some channel on the environment. And if I can generate that channel from just the output on B, then we can show that the channel is basically the coherent information is additive, so hashing is optimal. But you can actually show that this channel is not degraded, right? So somehow it's curious because, it's I guess, it just sort of points to a direction of movement, I guess, to try to understand the additivity of coherent information beyond just whether channels are degradable. And it seems like.
Can I have a question? Yeah. When you say that's not degradable, do you mean not degradable for all?
So it's degradable when, I guess, P is 0. And then for all P at least less than a half, it's not degradable. Okay. Sorry, yeah. But then P.
I think the important part is when P is close to the 0 range 1.
Yeah. Oh, well, this happens around sort of something less than a third.
Less than a third. So,
I think.
Is the channel degradable at that point?
No.
Well, I mean, these two poly channels have an interesting property. It's an intuitive calculation, but I usually use different parameters on what you call P, because when P is very small, the block sphere, sort of gets squished down a little.
Yeah, it's like, so.
But when P gets bigger, it looks like an American football.
Right, okay.
And one expects, it wouldn't be surprising if it were not degradable when it's squashed.
Right.
But it becomes degradable when it becomes a football. Because when it becomes a football, it's more, well, actually, when it becomes a football, it looks close to a dephasing channel.
So where does it turn everything into just a pancake, right? I think P would be equal to a half or three quarters. Okay, yeah. So certainly anywhere near where it has non-zero capacity, it's not degradable anyway. But it does seem to be additive, which is slightly, I don't know. You want to know why. As far as I'm concerned, it's not entirely true, but the only way that I really know how to show something's additive is to show it's degradable. And it's generally a pretty easy way to show things are additive. Anyway. I want to know whether this one's out of it. So maybe I just summarize a little bit. I mean, most things we don't know, but I guess I want to summarize what we do. The first is that, the best repetition code basically finds everything out about the X errors and somehow manages not to completely scramble the Z's. And maybe I didn't emphasize this enough, but if you choose a random code, that's exactly what happens. You completely scramble the Z's. So imagine you have one bit of entropy per qubit, and you start doing hashing. You want to learn the X's. If you choose just a random stabilizer code, what happens is you learn a bit about which X error happened, and you propagate sort of all the Z errors back to the logical qubits in such a way that, you've still got one bit of entropy per qubit. Whereas here, you sort of don't propagate back as violently, I guess. And then we have this sort of rule of thumb, I guess, for the repetition code length, which you can use to concatenate and get even sort of better rates. But for all of this, we only managed to beat hashing near where the rate goes to zero. And I don't know. I don't think this is really a necessity. So, yeah, let me, I guess, tell you what I think is the right way to generalize these sort of tidbits of phenomenology. Maybe if you take it as a given that what we want to do is we want to figure out what the amplitude errors are and do so in such a way that we sort of are as are as careful as possible, or don't screw up the Z errors too much. How to put this? A repetition code is fine for it; it works okay. But there are two problems. A repetition code is a horrible rate already, so we're never going to be able to do better than hashing anywhere except right near where the rate goes to zero. And furthermore, for each syndrome, of the repetition code that we measure, we'd really like to get out a whole bit of information about the XR. And we get much less than that for the, with this repetition code. So I guess the idea that we've been following up on, kind of enthusiastic about, is that, just concentrate on learning what the amplitude errors are. But do something smarter than the worst code you can think of, right? So the idea is find better code, or you want to find a better code to measure the x's. You want to get more information about the x's. And the key is that if you're getting more information per syndrome measurement about the x, you have to do fewer measurements. And then somehow you will screw up the z's. You'll propagate sort of less back to the logical space. Yeah?
Good question. There's a lot of error, like, remains the product of the, like, see, the stuff on the right is that the y error is kind of naturally coming out so that the x and the z's are independent. Do they remain independent?
The
x and the z error.
Oh, no, you don't have to start that they're independent either.
Like, so we don't need to worry about the y error.
No, so when I say learn the x error, I really mean learn the amplitude error, right? So you want to find out whether it's an x or a y, and then in the next stage, you want to find out whether it's a y or a z. Okay, I mean, I don't have much further to say about this that wouldn't be at least somewhat speculative, so I'll just move on to a bit of a summary. Last slide. So, I mean, roughly speaking, what do we know? Repetition code in basis of sort of the less probable error. So, like the z error. If the x error is the largest, you want to do repetition code in the basis of z error. That seems to do a little better than hashing in general, near the point where the hashing rate goes to zero. And at least as a rule of thumb, for most probabilities, if you take the block size of, or the length of your code to be 1/PZ, this is going to give you the best zero. And you can kind of use this rule of thumb to get sort of better code still for staging polarizing channel, for other channels too. And then there are two questions I really want to know the answer to. First is, well, is the two-polar channel additive or not? And that seems to me ideas beyond what I have. And then the second is, well, like I said, a repetition code if you went to a classical coding theorist and said, I have this great code, it's a repetition code, you just repeat all the information you want to store as much as, you know, as long as you want. This is a stupid code. There's got to be better ways to find out about the amplitude errors without totally scrambling the phase errors. Right, and that's it.
Any time for questions?
I was wondering if your analysis actually depends on the kind of stabilizers that you use for the code. Does it depend only on the code, or does it depend also on the way you extract the signal information? Because in some of the arguments, I had the impression that actually it would depend on the kind of stabilizers that you choose.
It only depends on the stabilizer, but it doesn't depend on the encoding and decoding operations.
That's not what I'm saying. But you made an analysis in terms of the generators of the stabilizer.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether your analysis depends actually on the choice of these generators, or any generator for the same stabilizer group would yield the same kind of analysis.
Any generator for the same group would yield the same analysis. It's just, I didn't show it, but basically, well, somehow if you have a description of the code space, it gives you the description of this phi, and the things I was plotting were exactly sort of the coherent information evaluated on this phi after sending out through the channel. And the description of the space doesn't depend on which stabilizers you're using, or sort of which generators you're using.
When you move away from the
Yeah. You can. Mm-hmm. You have actual probabilities Px, Py, and Pz. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, each of the blocks is not symmetric. You've also got, in some sense, a distinction. Assume you can identify a direction for what X, Y, and Z means.
Okay.
Okay. Now, it's conceivable that the actual error of the system is mapping the block sphere to something that's rotated. I mean, if you can correct all single qubit errors, mm-hmm. then you can correct anything.
Right.
But have you considered at all doing, you know, what happens to the analysis? Okay, if instead of having a certain problem, a model in which you have probabilities of Px, Y, and Z mm-hmm. along the axes on which you're defining the 0 and 1,
right.
but along some rotated axes.
Oh. It sounds hard.
And because the nice thing is that the you know, all the physical errors somehow also get mapped on, well, in the case that where you have these poly channels, all the physical errors by stabilizing could get mapped to other poly errors on the logical space. I wouldn't know what to do if that didn't happen. I don't think that happens in the case you're describing, right?
It does, yeah. I mean, in the real world, I mean, maybe in some systems like that. It's not so clear.
Oh, yeah.
The physical world knows what we've chosen for X, Y, and Z.
That's true. I mean, I kind of just want to understand the simplest possible channel, right?
Yeah.
I can't.
These things are hard.
But
I
mean, yeah, I don't have any information about anything beyond just poly. I mean, I would be okay. I don't have any information beyond the channels that I told you about, but I mean, it was not, I would be surprising if you didn't also get sort of beating, if you also didn't beat hashing for most general channels, right? It's to me like that. Anything else?
Oh, that was one thing about, well, it's kind of a bit tangential to what you're talking about, but is if you consider coarse codes that are sort of more like minimum distance codes, stabilizers, and are there instances where degenerate codes outperform more than non-degenerate codes can?
So you mean you want to correct sort of errors? You would like to correct all errors after they're fixed later, something like this?
Yeah, yeah.
So the codes here don't work for that. And there are no known codes that do work for that, but I think I know codes that do work for that. So, but the analysis doesn't.
That's kind of under the speculation
line. Yeah, yeah, it's even like down here.
Okay.
Works.
And is that dotted line, is that a new contribution?
Yeah, yeah, but it's new, like sort of too new. Well, yeah, this is just, it's completely unrelated to the stuff that I just want to advertise. It has to do with, so Andreas Linter and I were talking about, well, we found sort of an additive upper bound for maybe capacity, just, I guess, before QID.
So the Rank's line, is that an upper bound?
Yeah.
Yeah, this purple is upper bound, red line is upper bound, and then this is just sort of like, well, the thing we found is sort of like, it's got to be below these two things, and it's also got to be convex, so we've got to take the convex hull of those two things. I can tell you more about it.
There are no further questions. And the speaker again.